Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Education Subcommittee, is Thursday, March 29, 2007, 4:50 p.m.
Hey, good afternoon. In case you didn't know, March 29th, Thursday, 2007, you probably knew that. Beautiful afternoon. Glad to see so many of you are here. This is the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and we are grateful to have Portland Community College host this meeting today. We look forward to hearing your perspective and some testimonies concerning education issues. And before I invite the first speaker for this informational meeting, I would like if each of the members of the committee would briefly introduce themselves and the district that they represent and anything that they'd like to say. So if I could start perhaps with Senator Starr.
Great. Hi, I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I represent District 15, which is in western Washington County, the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Point.
And I'm Senator Frank Morris. I represent the Corvallis, Albany area of Lynn and Benton County.
I'm Senator Richard Devlin. I represent Senate District 19, which is Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, Lower Southwest Portland, and my district starts just basically at the entrance on Capitol Highway. This side is Representative Galizio and Senator Burdick. That side is mine.
And I'm Larry Galizio of House District 35, which encompasses primarily Washington County, City of Tigard, King City, but also includes the area around this campus, part of Multnomah County, and abuts Senator Devlin.
I'm Susan Morgan, and I represent the southern part of Douglas County and a little bit of Josephine and Jackson counties. The two community colleges that are in my legislative district are Umpqua Community College and Rogue Community College. And it may be interesting for you to know that there are two people on this committee that have chaired this committee in the past. Senator Devlin and I have both chaired this subcommittee in other sessions. So we're very happy to see an able legislator like Larry being able to take it over.
Thank you. I'm Bob Jensen, state representative from House District 58, which is principally Umatilla County, Pendleton, Hermiston, and the surrounding communities.
I'm David Edwards. I represent House District 30, which encompasses the greater part of Hillsborough, North Plains, and Roy and Verbort out in Washington County. I'm the freshman of the group, and this is not unlike my first year of college.
How did you do in college?
I aced it, sir.
Good. So, thank you very much. I also wanted to have Steve Bender, who's sitting to my right, introduce himself and maybe talk a little bit about what Legislative Fiscal does and your role. I appreciate that.
I'm Steve Bender with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and the Legislative Fiscal Office assists the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature at large in their process of developing a biennial budget. Post-secondary education.
So it's one of the greatest things about being in the legislature, and specifically in the Ways and Means Committee, is if you have a question about historic patterns of financing or anything in terms of whether it's higher education or K-12, you can go to the Legislative Fiscal Office and they'll provide you with that information, and it's a wonderful service. So glad, appreciate the fact that you're here today. So the idea today is to hear from all of you. And first, we've got some sort of invited testimony, people who are part of the community or part of Portland Community College and who are going to testify. In addition, some of you have already signed up. If you want to sign up, if you're here and you're not scheduled on the agenda and you would like to sign up and speak, I believe over on that table, you can just sign your name and we will get to you. So appreciate it. And with that, I'd like to call up, and I'm not sure in advance if we're going to have one or two people at the same time. You can sort of come up as you know. I have Jim Harper, who's the vice chair for Portland Community College. There you are. And then following, we'll have Christine Chersell. So, Mr. Harper.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Harper, and I'm on the board of directors of Portland Community College. I want to welcome you and thank you from the board of directors of Portland Community College for being here and giving us the opportunity to talk about the school. We have two of our directors also here today. The chair of our board, Jamie Lynn, is here. And David Squire is also here on the board of directors. And so we're here to talk to you a little bit. I've been involved with Portland Community College for 4 years. The first 20 years of that, I was involved as a user of the services.
Is that better?
That's perfect.
I was involved as a user working with Tektronix and Fokker Tronix. We did a lot of training. We did switching windows. We had instructions that came out in hot classes on our site. And so I've been really involved with the program side of the education. In 18 years, I've been on the board, foundation board, helping raise money for the school and working on scholarships and helping people that couldn't afford to go to school be more affordable and come into the classroom. And then for the last 2 years, I've been involved as a director and elected a few years ago to be on the board of directors. So I think it's a wonderful school. It's a private sector person out there. I can tell you that the Portland Community College across the state, especially here in the area that I'm familiar with, has been very strong and tried to go out to the community and talk to you about it. But as you know, in recent years, we've struggled. We've struggled with affordability and accessibility for students to get them in here. And you can see that after 18 years sitting on the scholarship committee trying to raise money and then award that to students. Right now, we're looking at something like $72 loaded per hour with everything, fees and everything included to go to school here at Portland Community College. But let me just talk for a couple of minutes about some of the facts of what this $529 million would mean to PCC. We could hire at least 25 full-time faculty in such areas as computer information systems, English as a second language, gerontology, dance, biology, welding, biotechnology, landscape, history, math, literature, business administration, aviation science, development education, social sciences, building construction, occupational therapy, computer application systems, geography, nutrition, and medical assistance. That's a lot of things that we could do. We could expand or create new professional technology programs that prepare Portland area residents for high demand, high skilled jobs in gerontology, welding, biotech, construction, occupational therapy, and medical assisting. This college also plans to make critical investments in student services that will enhance retention, transferability, and articulation to other agencies. PCC estimates that these investments would increase the number of its annual full-time equivalent FTE students by 1,700. This represents more than 10,000 additional students who would have access to higher education, well-paid careers through PCC. The number of new students could go even higher if the college could reduce tuition, which would be seriously considered at a $529 million level. The conclusion that I'd like to leave with you is that a small increase in funding for community colleges can make a huge difference in our ability to serve in the economic vitality of our state. Please do what you can to give the community college funding to the $529 million level we need to begin to restore services and academic programs for our students. Thank you for your support and for your help. I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harper. Any questions or comments? Well, I think we're...
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Very much appreciated. I'd like to call up Christine Chercel, who is PCC's District Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs. And just a question for those of you in the back. Can you hear okay? The microphone's working fine? Okay, great. No, they're not. Eric Sorensen, who's staff for legislative for committee services will continue to work on that. So give us feedback about whether or not there's feedback and whether or not you can hear. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that sounds better. I'd like to welcome you home, and I'd like to welcome the committee to the PCC Sylvania campus. My name is Chris Charisel, and I'm the District Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs. I'd first like to draw your attention to your packets. You have one sheet in your packet that is our vision and goals and values. This has been given to us by our Board of Directors, and this is what we use to reflect on before we begin any conversation. You'll see Portland Community College vision, mission. And I'll only draw your attention right now to the vision statement, and that is building futures for our students and communities. It certainly is what we are all about. PCC serves 1.4 million residents in a 1,500 square mile district that encompasses five counties in northwest Oregon. PCC serves a racially diverse population, but our own student population is much more diverse than our communities. PCC has four campuses, campus locations that reach to various communities, and these locations are vital in our ability to serve our district residents well and to provide access to our courses and programs. In addition to our physical locations, we have an outstanding distance education program that reaches any student who has access to a computer. And I believe you saw that on, you had an opportunity to talk to someone on your tour. We also share our accreditation with two contracting community colleges, Tillamook Bay and Columbia Gorge Community College. We enroll 88,000 students annually, although in 2002, over 105,000 students were able to attend our college. We have many challenges here that face PCC. First and foremost is the developing and maintaining an adequate resource base to keep our college accessible, to keep tuition affordable, maintain our lovely facilities, keep technology current, operate our programs, and develop success strategies for our students. Since the cuts in revenue in 2001, PCC has had to suspend or merge several academic programs, reduce the number of course offerings, and increase tuition and fees from $42 to $73 per credit hour. Today, tuition is now 36% of our operating revenue, as opposed to 25% in 2001. What does this mean to our community? Since 2002, you've probably heard over and over again, our students have declined by 17,000. 89% of that decline was in non-credit programs. When the legislature reduced the types of courses that would receive FTE reimbursement, we had to remove many of those courses. We are now making careful and strategic comebacks in those offerings, and we are carefully working within state parameters. In response to the reduced funding, we also limited credit course offerings, and let me give you an example. In fall 2006, we limited, because of limited funding, we reduced credit course offerings by 9% as compared to fall 2002. However, through sound and efficient enrollment management strategies, between fall 2002 and fall 2006, our FTE decreased only by 5.5%, not the comparable 9% decrease. At the community college's requested level of $529 million, we could begin to address our deferred maintenance backlog, avoid diminished services to our students, and more costly crisis remedies that exist today. Most important, PCC would address access and support issues to its diverse population of students in order to enhance retention, transfer, and articulation. Let me give you a couple examples. We need to reinstate full-time faculty positions that were lost in the budget cuts, and we need to hire new faculty as well. It would be a number between 16 and 25 new faculty that we could reinstate or hire. And I might add that we are only presently, before these hirings, five faculty positions away from our all-time high which was 399 faculty. I think PCC is committed to ensuring that our students have an opportunity to have a good relationship with excellent full-time faculty. The Pell Institute for the Study of the Opportunity in Higher Education lists three factors to improve student success. The first is an intensive advising system. The second is supplemental instruction like tutoring. And the third is building a structured academic and social community for first-year students. I think Representative Edwards probably excelled in college because he had those things. For the first time, PCC is proposing, for the first time in a long time, PCC is proposing an investment in student support systems much like what I've just mentioned. That would include mandatory advising for all first to PCC students. It would also include building a first-year experience for our students so that they engage with support people early on in their academic career, and these support people can help them navigate not only the academic but the personal experiences and challenges that often either postpone or derail the journey to success. We at PCC know that recruiting students costs more than the investment of retaining them. And this next academic year, our focus, our motto is going to be access and success. At the level of funding currently proposed by the legislature, we will not be able to implement any of these restorations or improvements. We will only be able to meet the contractual obligations of our employees and the must-do things like keeping the lights on. I think this has probably been described to you as a lost opportunity for PCC to provide outstanding instructional and student support services within our district. But the real cost will be the unfulfilled potential of our citizens and for business and industries. As the Chronicle of Higher Education so accurately pointed out this week, access without support is not an opportunity. We have other issues facing PCC in that we continue to respond to the business needs for trained workers. I think Director Harper pointed out many of those professional technical programs like gerontology and biotechnology can be brought back. The one thing that I'd like to point out is that workforce development is not limited to professional technical vocational programs. It includes high school students who are taking dual credit, and at PCC per year, it's about 3,000. It includes the college student who's preparing to transfer to the four-year institution for the bachelor's degree, the professional technical programs that give the students the high skills they need for a good vocational job, but also the displaced worker who comes to us with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree preparing for their next career. And that is a significantly growing population in all the community colleges. All of these students seek well-paying jobs, and in turn they contribute significantly as responsible citizens, and they contribute to the enrichment and the empowerment of our state economy through their own earnings and spending power. At PCC, we continue to strive to diversify our college faculty and our staff to better reflect our student diversity, and we want to maintain ourselves as a comprehensive community college, providing a solid mix of professional, technical, and academic programs, along with developmental education, adult basic education, English as a second language, and non-credit offerings. We continue to grow partnerships with other educational agencies to meet the needs of our students and to maximize our support for them. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I would first like to have everyone at PCC to please stand up. Mr. Chairman, PCC is a vibrant, healthy institution that is meeting the needs of many students. We could do even much more, offer access and strategies for success. Okay, everybody wake up. Gotcha, didn't I? I thought you snoozing. Prepare more workers for the workforce and for healthcare and other growing fields, and prepare more students to transfer to four-year institutions if we were funded at the level that all of Oregon's community colleges are asking for, $529 million. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think she just drove a new advertising slogan.
Very successful. So, thank you very much, Dr. Chair. So I don't know that you should leave yet. And now it seems like the microphone is working really well, so I think even if you're back a little bit from the microphone, it will work better. Are there any questions or comments? Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Chair, I know that $529 million is the community college request. I know how, how shocked some of the people were in the community college community by the co-chair's recommendation. But would it be possible for PCC not here today, but to indicate, like, in $10 million increments from the co-chair's level, what it would mean for the college? Because I can quite tell you, honestly tell you, that many of the people that are here today have had discussions with the co-chairs on amounts as small as $150,000. So I know that some people come to us and say that they need this much. But for us to understand what the impacts are at different levels, I think is very beneficial. And if we could get information like that from you and from other community colleges, I think it would be very helpful in our discussions with other people in the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, we would be more than happy to provide that information. This is my first year in building an entire budget here at PCC, and I am very impressed with being able to come in with priorities and amounts, and I think that we would be able to do that. It's quite conclusive.
Thank you. I had one question, Dr. Chair. So when you said 89%, we were talking about the 89% of the decline in terms of student numbers for non-credit programs. Could you just sort of flesh that out a little bit?
These are personal enrichment coursework, and it's my understanding that the legislature trimmed the types of courses that FTE could be reimbursed. I think now it's personal safety, health and welfare, a few others like that. And so we had to, I think it shows that we had a great deal of interest in the personal enrichment courses to have that many. But when we received that mandate, we had to trim it back and sit back and think about how is the best way we can serve our district and still remain viable. And so most of them were personal enrichment coursework.
Thank you very much. And I just wanted to clarify one thing. When Senator Devlin was talking and he mentioned $150,000, he wasn't saying that we were thinking about maybe increasing the community college budget. $150,000 was in the myriad of budgets, and you're looking at different items, there are discussions, sometimes intense discussions, about programs that... $150,000. So I just wanted to, for the record, clarify
we
that.
We're making about $150,000.
Yeah. So. Nice save, Mr. Chair.
Well, I wanted to turn it to Representative Morgan.
Well, just with reference to the personal enrichment classes, I chaired the subcommittee in the 03 session when we were making very difficult decisions because of the financial situation that the state was in. And one of the discussions that we had at that time was with the diminished support that the state was able to invest in the process, that in order to protect the college transfer and the technical training pieces of the community college system, the decision was made to instruct the system not to use the state subsidy for the personal enrichment classes and instead use it to help maintain some of the classes in the technical training and college transfer piece. Again, difficult decisions and something that we're dealing with now. I would also like to echo Senator Devlin's request for information from the system about the levels of service that would be provided under the co-chair's budget and levels of service that would be provided under the funding level that's in the governor's recommended budget. I think that if we have that information in this committee as we go through the funding level discussion, it's going to be much easier for us to see the impact. One of the things I think that would be good for us is if the overall system took the performance measures and charted on them what the outcomes would be on the performance measures at both of the funding levels.
We would be happy to do that.
And just for those of you who, for clarification, the co-chair's budget, the amount for the operating budget for community colleges works out to about $458 million. The governor's recommended budget, $483 million. And, of course, today we're having discussions about desire for $529, so there's a bit of a gap there. So just for clarification on that number. So, further questions or comments? Well, thank you very much, Dr. Trussell. Appreciate it. All right, now I'm going to call up the Commissioner for Community College Services, Cam Pruse-Brawley, no stranger to this committee.
Let me apologize first to the audience. It's awkward to have my back to you. And I also must apologize because I didn't bring 150 pieces of paper. But I did bring copies for the committee. And because I'm going to be in front of the committee in about 2 weeks, I decided to be brief and global in my presentation this evening, knowing that you have a long lineup of people to hear from today about community colleges and PCC in particular. What you have in front of you is a document that I share with the 17 community college boards. I make a trip around every year and engage them in conversation and try to bring them up to date about where are the community colleges as a whole, as a system, in enrollment and spending and tuition, so that each college board gets a sense of not just what they're doing and the difficult decisions they have around which programs to continue or cut, what to do with tuition, but they have a sense of what does it look like statewide. So I have modified this just in the last week with the inclusion of the co-chair's budget. But what I wanted to do, I'm just going to do this very briefly, is look at the pictures. If we look at the graphs on the very first page under the heading of what's happened to enrollment, it certainly amplifies what Ms. Chersell just finished giving you for PCC. Headcount was at an all-time high in 2001 before we hit our recession or depression, if you talk to a community college. And our enrollment was over 400,000. It dropped to a low of 330,000 in 2003, and now headcount is making its way back up. We find ourselves in 2005 or 6 at 357,000 students. Full-time equivalent students has not done as well in the rebound. At the height of 2001-02, we were at 102 full-time equivalent students. We're now at 91,000. So we're still off more than 10,000 students. And certainly your recent conversation about adult continuing education accounts for about the total enrollment of about 10% in 2001 and about 4% now. But if we were to look at each program area in the community colleges, lower division transfer is held very steady. Professional technical has declined. Unfortunately, adult basic education has also declined. So we do see some shift in where students are enrolling. If you turn to page 2, this is the conversation about what's happening with funding. Reverberating. The very first bar graph gives you a look of what appropriation has been for the last decade for community colleges. And you can see it doesn't look like it has changed an awful lot, except that 2001-03 at $375 million. That's the session that we left. Our legislatively approved budget was $467 million by the time we were finished with the five special sessions. Sometime in 2003, we were down to $375. And much of what you see reflected here is the college's valiant effort to recover from that large of a size of a reduction in state support. If you look at the second bar graph, then you see state support for student for a full-time equivalent. And the shaded or hashed bar there is what we currently pay to a community college for a student in the current biennium at $2,398, or just about $2,400. The governor's recommended budget was pegged student support at $2,700, and as you'll see in some of the sidebar conversation there, that is the highest level of support for students since the mid-90s. I have added a new bar, which is the co-chair's budget, which does show the $2,560 per student, which, yes, is higher than where we are today, but not what was in the governor's budget. The last graph on page 2 is important only because it runs back all the way to before measure, or as measure 5 passed. And you can see the difference in proportionality of where the funding for community colleges has come from. Shift of state general fund to take the place of a loss in property tax, or at least a holding down of property tax, and the increase in tuition revenue. What does it mean for community college students on to page 3? That bar graph is coupled with really the top graph on page 2 and perhaps the top graph on page 1, which is the loss of course sections. I think this is perhaps the most illuminating graph in this document. It shows in 2002-03, we were, I'm sorry, at 2001-02, again, that banner year for community colleges, we had 93,296, almost 94,000 course sections that were offered across the 17 community colleges. In 2003-04, that had dropped to 81,670. So a loss of that magnitude does help explain why community college enrollment has been is so reduced, as well as why you can see we are only very slowly making our way back to add those course sections back. We're back to about 86,000, but we're still 7% below where we were. And I would challenge anyone that I know the students are out there. They just aren't unable to either access because of cost or because of capacity and room in the classroom. So what does this mean for educational attainment if we were to back way up and say, okay, why does all of this matter about community colleges? It matters because Oregon has a goal of having a much more highly educated citizenry than we currently have in order to be competitive into the future. Education of having a diploma and having a family wage job is a thing of the past. And you'll see at the bottom of page 3 some bar graphs with some percentages. And I know that Representative Morgan, you participated, I believe, in an interim committee that looked at how we ought to, what we ought to aspire our education system to accomplish for us. And we came to this 40-40-20. 40% of Oregon citizens should have a bachelor's. 40% of Oregon citizens should have an associate's or a credential. And no less than 20% should only have a high school diploma, knowing that a high school diploma really doesn't buy you much in the labor market, even today and especially in the future. And then you'll see that middle graph really tells you where Oregon is. And we have a distance to go in all three areas. So I guess the thought I would like to leave you with is the investment that you make in community colleges is going to make a difference, not just today and not just to the students in this room, but to Oregon's vitality and economic prosperity. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much. Ms.
Ms. Crawley, are there any questions or comments?
I think because we know we're going to see you in the not too distant future, we're going to take advantage of it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good to see you. It's great.
This is well done.
Yes, yeah, very helpful. I can tell all of you are getting more tan just in the time you've been here. So, all right, now I'd like to call up Jeff Van Raden from Columbia Industries. Mr. Van Raden.
Thank you for the opportunity first. My name is Jeff Van Raden. I'm also a PCC alumni from 1977. Graduated in the engineering course here. Also the director of marketing and general manager of our company. And so I wear a lot of hats there and have a lot of concern. Also, excuse me, I'll also mention that I'm also a PCC Foundation board member. And I just really wanted to have this opportunity or thank you for this opportunity to let you know how important we think this is and this appropriation for this money. Our company has had a very close relationship with PCC, not just myself, but in fact we have a retiring engineer who's a PCC graduate. But most of our skilled welders are coming from Ford Community College Rock Creek campus. And what we're finding is that there is a definite trend in the welding industry, retiring welders. We're seeing about a third of them are going to disappear over the next 10 years. You know, for a company like us who's trying to expand, and we have just invested several million dollars in our facility and building a new 36,000 square foot facility to build larger equipment for the oil industry and for the solid waste industry. These are all proprietary designs and things that have come from our company, and we keep it right here in Oregon and do our very best to keep the synergy here as well so that it builds on itself. We are, I think, a rare company, and we export equipment, heavy equipment, into China. So I think that what we're doing is fairly unique and important to us, obviously, but also to the community. And what we're finding is that about half of our shop now, our welders, are now PCC graduates, thankfully. Otherwise, I don't know what we'd be doing. But I have this building I need to fill with welders over the next 2 years and expect to hire about another 20. And right now, my best, most reliable source for those people will be Portland Community College's Rock Creek campus. Right now, they are full. They cannot bring another student in. They don't have enough staff. And I'm on their advisory committee. So obviously, it's very important to me how well this campus does. But I think that mainly, it's that we've got maybe another 2 years, and faculty alone won't solve the problem. That we cannot put enough engineering students through this facility there. And, you know, so we're looking, obviously the school's going to need to expand if it's going to continue, having the opportunity to fill these ranks of welders that are needed. We expect that over these next 2 years that this opportunity could also come and go. And without this ability to, have this work in hand and be able to continue to feed the people into our facility and be able to bid on this work, and it's just critical to us that we have this group. And again, I know that these funds could also be used to, open another facility in the southeast Portland area, which, for us, we realize a lot of these students, they don't have a lot of opportunity, and, often they're in the community, and they can take a bus, or they can ride their bikes. But this facility over in southeast Portland really could open up, the opportunity to a lot more young people out in that area that don't have that ability to get to Rock Creek campus. And again, we just have such a need in the area. It's a competitive field, and we're competing with all the large steel fabricators in the area for these people. And it's a little worrisome. And I honestly see this as an excellent opportunity for the state to recognize the college and help us industry people get the personnel we need and a future we need. PCC has helped us in a lot of ways. We've gone to them not just for welders, but for our engineers and also for our mechanical draftsmen. It's just a very, very critical institution for us. And I just wanted to make sure that, again, I have an opportunity to answer questions or... Obviously, I'm a little nervous at this.
No,
it was more important for me to be here than for me to be concerned about it. So.
And we really appreciate Mr. Van Raden. Nobody's more nervous than those of us up here after the... So I actually had a couple questions, if I might. So could you just a little bit about the salary range for welders? Sort of an idea. And then also, you know, the number of employees that you have and your projected needs.
Well, we're just under 50 people, first of all, and about half of our crew is in the shop and half in the office. So we've got about what we call our fabricators, which are the people who actually make it happen. We've got about 20 of them. And what we think we're going to need is about 20 more for this new building to start with. And again, it will come over a period of time because we just know you don't go out and grab 20 welders. It just doesn't happen. We've tried in the past when we've had very large jobs come through that we end up sending out to facilities all over the Pacific Northwest because there isn't facilities in Portland. You know, we're often up in Longview, Washington, and sending work out of our state. And that's not something we've been wanting to do. We can control our quality a lot better and the whole process if it's happening in our shop and with our people. And we're a third-generation family business. It's a business my grandfather started back in the 40s, and we think we got a pretty good handle on how all this works. We do realize that there's a lot of trends in the business, and that it goes up and down. But we're, the two businesses we're involved in, one of them tends to be going up, and garbage is just a busy industry. The nation is challenging us constantly to figure out more ingenious ways of dealing with this. And so there's a lot of opportunity there. We've been in this industry for a long time.
That's our morning.
Just to warn you that we're not nearly as scary as we look up here. One of the things that is interesting to see develop, especially in the community college system, is the partnerships between the businesses that use the graduates and the training capacity. Does your business participate with the college here in terms of contributing expertise and equipment? And just what's the interaction?
Well, I've been working with the welding department for quite a long time and as on the advisory committee, but also helping them with their next. They also applied for and received a National Science Foundation grant, a large one, and really allowed the welding department to put themselves on the map. They have developed a training program that they've sent out all over the country that a lot of other community colleges are trying to pick up on. But there's a little bit more to it. And there's some magic involved, and it really has to do with the people. And that's why I'm there, because I have a relationship with these people. I think I know what their hopes and dreams are, and I think that they're pure at heart and good heart, hard-working people. Most of the people that we've worked with at Portland Community College have come out of industry, whether it's been through the engineering department. All my professors were industry individuals. Don Mash, who worked on the Manhattan Project. We've had some very incredible people come through this school as far as instructors. And the same thing you find at the welding department. There are people out of industry there. And yeah, so it makes it very easy. Actually, I am trying to get a machine set up in there right now. But it has been a little difficult for me as a small business to make some of these arrangements to get some of this. So I've dedicated more of my time and employing as many people as I can get. But there's more we can do. There's more that needs to be done. And I think that is really the industry's responsibility to step up. It's a partnership. And we all know it, and it's crucial, though, that I think the state recognizes, you know, a good effort when they see one. And I just can't think of a better place for the state to invest its money. We just see a lot of benefits out of it right in the community, and it makes a huge difference to Columbia. and the other companies that we work with. And so again, we just very much hope that the committee could see itself to approving this funding increase for the state and all the community colleges, because it really will greatly improve the bottom line. I'm also here as a grandfather, and probably the biggest reason I'm here is the hope, you know, that we can all hold this community together for what it really is and what it really has to offer. And that's more than you can put on a piece of paper. But it's a commitment, and I think you'll find it here at this school more than you will anywhere else.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Reden. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. So when I was talking with Portland Community College and the other community colleges, just because this committee, and I want to make it very clear that obviously there are 90 legislators, and we don't control, maybe we'd like this, but we don't control the decisions that everyone makes. But what our charge is to look at the education budgets, to look at community college, to look at K-12, to look at the Oregon University system, to look at Oregon Health Sciences University. And so one of the conversations that I think was started really by the governor's budget, talking about the education enterprise, in other words, really looking at the link between the different K-12, community college, and OUS. So I asked if, when we were here today, if we could hear from people who are involved in the link between the community college and high school. So with that, I'm going to ask Pamela Blumenthal, who's PCC Alternative Programs Manager, and Kyle Rasmussen, who is part of the Gateway to College. Oh, no, it was a Gateway to College program student. Pardon me. So, good to see you. And don't put that too close, because now it's working really well. I mean, you can get a little closer, but...
He's a musician. He knows about.
Oh, okay. All right, you can help us out.
Hi, my name is Pam Blumenthal. I'm manager of student support and retention with PCC Prep Alternative Programs. We're very happy to be here to tell you about the unique programs that PCC has offered to high school age students. We serve at-risk youth between the ages of 16 and 20. Our programs are aimed at offering a variety of educational options for out-of-school and at-risk youth. We have programs at all campuses of PCC. Some of our students, I'll talk about our three programs, and you have information on all three. One of our programs is the Multicultural Academic Program, the MAP program, and in that program we are working with students mostly that are new to this country and helping them with English acquisition in order for them to pursue their academic goals. And all of our programs have support people called resource specialists that offer support and guidance to students while they're in their program. In the MAP program, we have bilingual resource specialists. Another program is the YES program, which stands for Youth Empowered to Succeed, and that is a GED prep program. Students are in ABE GED classes, preparing to take their GED test, but they also get a resource specialist to offer life skills classes and support them while they're in the program and help them beyond the GED to transition into career or ongoing education. And then Gateway to College is our high school completion program, where students earn dual credit. They're earning high school credit and college credit at the same time. They start out in a small learning community where they learn the necessary skills to be successful in college, and then they transition to take comprehensive college classes with all the students here at PCC. They're working towards a high school diploma, but they're also earning credits toward an associate degree, and they choose a pathway in their second term with us. Their resource specialist acts as a mentor, an advisor, counselor, and helps them navigate the complex system of college. We regularly see students who have dropped out of high school for various reasons become successful college students, and when they never thought this was a possibility for them. Gateway to College is also being replicated throughout the country through a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We currently have 12 Gateway to College sites across the country. Our outcomes, our goals for students in Gateway to College is to earn a credential, either a GED or a high school diploma, and for them to continue their education. We focus on credit acquisition, and students who obtain a high school diploma through Gateway to College end up with an average of 70 college credits. Some of them actually earn an AA and a high school diploma at the same time. More than 70% of our graduates go on to continue post-secondary education. For students who are not successful in Gateway to College, we encourage them to pursue their GED and help them get enrolled in that program or other alternative programs in the community. Our partnerships with K-12 education are paramount to our success. We currently have contracts with 8 school districts in the Portland metro area, and we work very closely with counselors and principals, teachers, and others involved in the school districts. We accept students with have special ed needs, and we work to collaborate between the Office for Students with Disabilities here at the college and have partnerships with the special ed personnel in the districts. So some Portland Public Schools actually has a special ed teacher that is assigned to work with us and comes on site to work with students. We also are part of a coalition of metro area community-based schools. There are many different alternatives for students in the Portland area, and we are part of that group to mobilize and accessing students who have dropped out of school and get them back involved in education. Last year, we co-sponsored an event called the Comeback Fair, which will be happening again this year to get high school age students and other students back into school and other career opportunities. I think that's all I have. I'm going to let Kyle tell you a little bit about his pathway. He started in the S program and obtained his GED, and he is now in his fifth term in Gateway to College. Fourth term in Gateway to College, and he is pursuing a degree in music.
I'm Kyle Rasmussen. First off, when I began my career in high school, within the first 4 months of my freshman year, I kind of realized that...
I'm sorry, I just want to make sure people can hear. I think you need to move a little bit closer. So.
Better?
I think so. Thank you.
In the first 4 months, I kind of realized that this really wasn't the place I needed to be. And everybody has their own reasons, but one of my biggest reasons and one of the most common of my peers in this program is the severe lack of maturity from the students, organization, and just the compassion on both sides, the students and the teachers. Nobody cared enough to pursue their education, and the teachers didn't care enough to make them want to pursue their education. So in the first 4 months, I kind of decided that I wasn't going to attend anymore. So I was technically a dropout at that point. After about 2 years of being out of the educational system and having full-time employment at Taco Bell, I kind of realized that I should get going with my education. And I explored a lot of my options and opportunities, and PCC was really close. I live near the Southeast campus, and so I just walked in there, and your high school doesn't really provide you with a lot of options. They just tell you it's high school and that's it. So I had to kind of go on a personal quest. Walked into PCC and I just figured I'd get my GED. That was the most reasonable, logical thing I could do. And I talked to a resource specialist and was directed to the YES program, the Youth Empowered to Succeed. And within 2 months, I had my GED. And he presented me with a Gateway to College program that I'd never heard of. And I was looking for a catch because it was really, honestly, a second chance. I mean, for students who have special circumstances, they didn't drop out because they didn't care. They didn't drop out because, you know, they just didn't want to be in school. I very much cared about my education. and so did all my peers. It's a very rigorous program, so you have to care to make it through. And everything I found in the Gateway to College program was everything that my high school experience was lacking. All of the students were treated as adults, so they acted as such. My resource specialist, I was having issues showing up on time, and he'd call me every morning to make sure I was awake. And they care more than, they're like at risk of sounding cheesy. My resource specialist feels like part of my family at this point. And it's just a perfect balance between learning responsibility, maturity, adult habits, and still being nurtured and treated like, you know, you need direction, and we're going to give that to you. So that's what I love about the Gateway to College program, and that's why I've been in it for 4 terms now.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Rasmussen.
I'd be happy to take any questions.
Sure. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Blumenthal, just out of curiosity, how do you work with, like, local school districts or principals of local high schools in terms of, in some ways, I think you could identify students that might be in this situation. I know all of us that have seen the high school graduation statistics know that also there's a group of students that actually go through all 12 years and never graduate.
Right.
I mean, they're there in physically, but they still don't graduate. And obviously there are other students that leave, some of them even leave them before the 10th grade, some leave in the 10th and the 11th and the 12th grade.
We work very closely we send out information about our programs and brochures to all the counselors and maintain as much contact as we can through emails and upcoming events to make sure that it's in the forefront of their minds when they're working with students, that these are options for them. We had a student apply to Gateway to College this term who was in their, you know, almost the spring of their senior year with 8 high school credits and a 0.86 GPA. So how you get to that... that far along without anybody intervening in these large tools, I guess that's just part of the problem. But we do what we can to get the word out that this is an available option, and the school districts are very supportive because they're still considered part of their school district when they're in our program. They're still enrolled in their district. They're being served by us as a community-based alternative. So it's a win-win for the school district. And we're funded through, it's passed through funding of the per pupil net operating expenditure. So we get a portion of that through the district.
Thank you. I had a question for Mr. Rasmussen. So you're a musician and
Correct.
You're studying music. What instrument, if any, do you play? And what's the plan in terms of studying music?
I'm a guitarist, and a big part of my inspiration to get back into school was not really, I mean, I'm really concerned with a career, but more so I just wanted to further myself as a musician, because that's what I'm passionate about. And I plan to, luckily, I came into this program with 0 high school credits. So, which means this is, you know, other than fees every once in a while, I'm pretty much have the opportunity to get my associate's degree for free if I get it through this program. And after that, best case scenario, I would like to transfer to Berklee in Boston, which is a music school, music college. And as far as what I'm going to do from there, if I want to, I think I may go into recording, but who knows. And just to go back on that last part that you asked, personally knowing people who reached that level, got into the 12th grade and, you know, graduation day came along and they realized they didn't have enough credits, it was just, there was no communication between the teachers and the student. The student, for those 4 years of high school, they went through failing classes and nobody stopped them. Nobody grabbed them and said, hey, look, you're behind this much, you're going to have to do this and this to graduate on time. It was kind of like, you know, your 4 years is up, you're a senior, you don't have enough credits, either you can come back or you're out of luck. So that was another thing I really wasn't too fond of with the high school experience.
All right, well, Mr. Rasmussen, Ms. Blumenthal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you.
So, is it Bowie? Did she make it through the traffic? Did I pronounce your name correctly? Sarah Bowley is the assistant superintendent for the Beaverton School District. Wow, you get your own microphone, brand new. Yes, and we'll take it away. When you're done, we take that away and
okay.
Present it to you, and you go back to your boring other microphone.
Can we frame it?
Yeah.
Okay. I am the Deputy Superintendent for Teaching and Learning for the Beaverton School District, but I also want to make certain you know that I spent 10 years as a high school administrator in the Beaverton School District. I've been with the district over 34 years and was absolutely thrilled to be able to help open Westview High School and Southridge High School. And I am no stranger to what happens when you open the doors of opportunity for all students. The student you just heard from was a student who had that experience. Sadly, not throughout all of his high school career, but certainly through the connection to community college. I know that the real test for me of whether or not a school has done its job is when I go to a high school graduation and I shake each graduate's hand, and I always ask them the same question. Besides congratulating them, I always ask them, potential has not been tapped. And probably this student doesn't even have it in his family's thinking that he or she should be going on for post-secondary education. What surprised me, even in my own school district, despite all the work we had been doing a few years ago with options programs, is when I first took over this job, how many students in our options programs told me they hadn't any idea when they walked across the stage. There was always one notable exception. Many of the students have been contacted by PCC. And PCC was the one entity in our area which I could be assured of had attempted to make contact with all of the counselors about specific students who may, in fact, be great candidates for an associate's degree or for transfer credit to a four-year university. And also we had such wonderful partnerships with PCC over the years that I knew when it really came time to push on the entire system and ensure that every single student had the opportunity to realize their dreams and achieve an education beyond high school, I knew PCC was going to be helping us, and they certainly did. But first of all, I want to tell you about something that happened in the district. We have definitely ramped things up in the last few years, and we believe absolutely we know how to enable every single student to realize their potential. We are in the process of aggressively moving on a system that is pre-K all the way, seamless system that helps students transition through college and even be thinking about their graduate work as well. The thing that was pivotal for us, though, I think, in the very first year, 3 years ago we did this, we gave all students the ACT exam. And honestly, part of that was to help us determine where our preparation might be weak, where we may need to really improve what we were doing for kids. What we learned is we were doing better than we thought we were doing. And what was sad is a lot of kids didn't know that because our assessments were not where they needed to be. The state's working on that. We're working on that. Districts are developing formative assessment systems that will help them diagnose where students are on an individual basis. We call it the individual student growth model in districts. And the state as well is working on the assessment system, too, as you know. But sadly, many kids still don't know how much they can do. So what we discovered is that we needed to reforecast students the first year we did that. And we ended up with literally hundreds of students taking AB and IP classes who may never have intended to do that. Fortunately, we were able to provide the resources that would enable them to do that, the teacher training, the textbooks. What we also discovered is we had many kids who were in that situation, well prepared for college, who'd never thought about going, and who were beginning to fall through the cracks. So we moved on, and we also had a capacity issue. We needed some full-day options for students because Beaverton is at 37,000-plus students now and growing. It's anticipated to be the largest school district in the state within a decade. And we have over 90 different language groups. The diversity is astounding. We've welcomed the challenge. It has been a tremendous benefit. But the diversity in our community now ranges from families whose children have never experienced running water and much less a public schooling system to those who are coming from other countries where the only system of schooling is highly exclusive. You begin college at 16, and it has to do with who your family is. So we just have tremendous diversity in the district. Well, what we learned is that many of these students probably would never, and we've had to face this, it's been difficult in public schooling, but because of the proliferation of a variety of innovations from the smaller learning communities, high schools, to a variety of other early college and middle college options for students, we have learned that not all students are going to fare well in big, huge high schools, and Beaverton has some of the biggest, which is probably partly why over the years we have taken advantage of nearly every single PCC program, and I believe you have the handout on the PCC programs, and it sounds to me as if PCC is going to be going through these with you, or already has gone through many of them. One that does not appear on here is early college high school, which is our Senate Bill 300 option in Beaverton. And what happened as a result of that ACT is we found, and we're still finding, kids in the system who are college ready already, even as 10th graders, many of them. We weren't certain if the early college high school would take off. We had consulted the Gates Foundation about the best programs they knew of in the country, and of course they mentioned the Gateway to College program here, but also they connected us with some other states. We worked with Guilford County and Maryland on options and opened our first early college high school just before Senate Bill 300 came out. So it worked beautifully for us. And PCC was a wonderful partner. I have been trying to get the same thing started here at Sylvania before it had a name, several years before when I was at Southridge. We had many students who were interested. What an early college high school option did is it allowed a student to begin studying at the college as an 11th grader and earn both their high school diploma and an associate's degree at the same time. And if they were studying in engineering, or in a related field, often they could earn transfer credit to Oregon State that would satisfy, I believe for one student it was something like 15 credits. For one, I even heard there was as much as a full year of transfer credit. But don't quote me on that one because students have varying stories depending on what their needs are. So as we have needed to personalize more and more, we have developed more options. And this one, we started with 100. That is our Senate Bill 300 cap. We wish they would lift the cap because right now we have 200 more students who we believe are very capable, ready, and able to attend. It is incredibly compatible with all we are doing. We have districts calling us daily to find out more about it. We are on the cusp of change. We desperately need our community colleges. They can help provide us with a transition for students, a stepping stone that many students need. And we're very excited. I know my time here today is limited, but I could tell you many, many stories about what happens to students when you open the doors to opportunity and you tear down barriers to access. And if we scale back on community colleges, if we scale back on our four-year universities, we will also scale back on the transition staff that we hire in schools. It's just inevitable. And it would be a tragedy because we are truly on a roll right now in ensuring that kids get their needs met and every single student gets to college. So anyway, I'd like to give you a little bit of time to ask me any questions. Obviously, there's an awful lot I could talk about in connection with options and high school students.
We appreciate it. And time is always the question. So are there any? Yeah, we're kind of running behind. So
yeah,
did I pronounce it as a bold?
Yeah.
Bold. Thank you very much for taking the time to come out.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
You're very welcome. That was just very general, but you.
No, we appreciate it.
You know, it matters to schools.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Linda West. Are you here? No. Okay. Breanne Fisher. Sylvania Associated Students, a PCC senator. Senator? Okay. Excuse me. How about Deborah Lynn Porter? I have a couple of students, Deborah Lynn Porter and Melissa Summers. Are you? That's. Would you come up together?
Chair Galizio, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Porta, and I'm a student at Portland Community College and vice president of the Cascade Student Government. As a member of student government, I see and hear firsthand the struggles that students are having in trying to get their educations in an underfunded system. I hear their stories about making choices, choosing between textbooks and groceries, choosing between getting to the doctor or getting their bus pass. But the students I know are seeing through their commitments to their education and advancing in their lives. Students that I know don't want a free ride, and they don't want an easy way. What they want and need is for their school, their community, and their state to be as committed to them as they are to their goals and community in return. The consistent underfunding of community colleges over the last 6 years has sent a clear message, at least in the eyes of students, that the commitment and support they seek has not been there. In the time I've been at PCC, tuition has doubled, whole programs have been cut, advising at all levels has been decreased to the point where many students don't even bother. In a day when computer skills are a basic necessity for any kind of sustainable employment and for even the most basic class assignments, computer tutoring is non-existent. Along with these service cuts, available class sections have been cut to the point where it delays students in even graduating on time. Community college administrations are being forced to make some really hard choices, and any of those choices resulting in the loss of a service to students is hurting those students. The students themselves have begun taking on the task of providing the services they need for themselves. I know that at Cascade, the student government is spearheading the development of additional tutoring resources. All of the campus student governments have set aside thousands of student fee dollars to assist the student body with child care. We run book exchange programs to try and provide textbooks at affordable prices. Students have even taken on the burden of increased printing costs because department budgets have been cut to the point where instructors cannot even afford to print class materials. It isn't simply about the rising cost of tuition anymore. Students are bearing more and more of the operating costs and repercussions of an underfunded community college system, and that is directly impacting the accessibility that community colleges provide to higher education and the irreplaceable place that community colleges have in providing a well-trained, productive workforce for our state. As an Oregonian, I'm very concerned about the looming healthcare provider crisis and the fact that community college nursing programs that provide 50% of the nursing workforce are currently underfunded to the point where the waiting list to even get into the program is measured in years, not months. As an Oregonian, I'm concerned about Oregon's ability to attract and retain businesses that depend on an educated workforce. The importance that community colleges have in Oregon cannot be underestimated, and we ask as students, as the 400,000 Oregon Community College students attempting to obtain their educations and become fully productive citizens of the state, we ask that you fully support us in fully supporting the funding, $529 million, that is needed at this point to even begin catching up on the losses of the last 6 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Summers.
Chair,
I think you're going to move that microphone a little closer.
Please. Chair Galizia and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Summers, and I attend Portland Community College, Rock Creek Campus, and am the Director of Legislative Affairs in our student government. I'm here to testify today in support of increasing the community college allocation and reinstating the student child care program in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget. As a student parent, I have consistently struggled to obtain my associate's degree in accounting. I decided to go to college 3 years ago because I feel with a college education, I will be able to create a better life and future for my daughter Chloe and myself. I made the decision to attend a community college because it was the only viable option for me financially. For the first 2 years, my daughter was not yet in school full-time, so she attended a private daycare every day. Despite the grant and loan aids that I did receive, I still cannot afford the $600 monthly child care payments without working full-time. I worked 12-hour shifts for General Motors 3 days a week on a graveyard shift. When I completed work at 9 a.m., I would have to be to class by 10 a.m., get home about 2 or 3 p.m., sleep for 4 hours, go back to work. And so oftentimes I'd be able to study at night while I was at work, though. I hope to complete my degree this term. Unfortunately, due to lack of course offerings at my campus, due to past budget cuts, two of the required courses that I must take to complete my degree are only offered at night this next term, which means I'm going to have to pay for additional child care, as my daughter is usually with me in the evenings after she gets out of school. And I will also have to spend less time with her than I did before. I was very excited when she started first grade this year because that meant I could take classes during the day and I would be able to be with her at night. And unfortunately, that's not the case, as most of the classes I need to complete my degree are only offered at night for me this year. And so that is also making it harder for me to spend time with my daughter outside of the weekends and then the few nights that I'm not going to be in class. As I stated before, the reason I'm in school now is to provide a better future for myself and my daughter. I want my daughter to have the ability to attend and graduate college so she can improve herself when she's of that age. In fact, I've already required that she saves half of all of her personal money and is put into a bank account for college savings. So the dream of her going to college is also very real to her. I'm here to tell you my story in hopes that you consider funding community colleges at a higher level for Oregonians like myself, who rely on community colleges to achieve a better future and will be able to continue to receive an affordable, accessible, and quality education. I also wanted to be here today to tell you what it's like for me as a student parent in light of the fact that the co-chair's budget did not include any funding for the student child care program. I urge you to support the student child care program, which is now housed in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, but again received no funding by the co-chairs. While this program is currently serving almost 300 families, there are over 1,000 Oregon student parents on the waiting list. This valuable program, that while it has been underfunded in the past with $1 million allocation, is still a small solution to the problem and thus a valuable program, especially considering that the number one indicator of whether or not someone will attend college is if their parents went to college. As I mentioned before, I have a strong desire for my daughter to attend college, and I believe that the student child care program will help me help her to do so. Again, I urge you to fund the student child care program with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Summers. Any other questions? So I had a question. You said there were two classes that you couldn't get. What were those classes?
Governmental accounting and financial accounting.
And what you needed them to be for what times?
During the day when my daughter's at school, and I'll be taking one from 6 to 9. And
so you needed them to be anytime during the day?
Anytime while she's at school.
And you couldn't find a... At this campus only?
At the Rock Creek.
At the Rock Creek. And there's a manager from General Motors who wants to talk to you after.
Question?
Well, thank you both very much. Really appreciate it. Okay, did Linda West or Brianne Fisher perchance come in? Okay, good. All right, Mr. Michael Dembro, the PCC Faculty Federation President. My president, you don't mind, I've got to eat something while you're talking, so don't take it personally.
Are there no eating signs here somewhere? There you go. Thank you, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. My name is Michael Dembro, and I am the president of the Portland Community College Faculty Federation, which represents the nearly 2,000 full-time and part-time faculty and academic professionals here at PCC. And so on their behalf, I welcome you back, or if this is your first time, to the campus. I'm also a vice president of AFT Oregon, which represents faculty and staff at Oregon's largest community college, this one, but also some of its smallest and most rural. And in addition, I've recently had the honor of being appointed by the State Board of Education to be its first community college faculty advisor. So I hope I can bring to you a perspective that is both local and statewide. But I'm going to start with the local perspective. In my day job, I teach English at Portland Community College, which I have done for 25 years now. Cascade, located in inner northeast Portland, is the most ethnically diverse post-secondary campus in the state, and our students include the college's most economically disadvantaged. I can tell you from personal experience that there are thousands of individuals and their families out there whose lives have been transformed by our work, who have been brought into the economic mainstream thanks to their experience with us. Many thousands more are waiting to join them. As I'm sure you know, they are the future of Oregon, the pool of diverse talent that is going to drive the state's economic engine and provide us with the citizen leaders that will move this state forward. But for that, they need access to higher education. And for most Oregonians, there is only one way to gain that access, and that's through the state's community colleges. Knowing that, one would expect a forward-looking state to be investing heavily in its community college infrastructure, both its human infrastructure and its physical infrastructure, in charting a future that moves Oregon to the forefront of the nation, if not the world. Yet what the young people of this state have seen is the very opposite. And I think you just heard that sentiment from our two students who spoke, what it feels like not to see that investment. I don't need to tell you how much our ability to provide quality instruction to these students has been compromised by the budget cuts of the last 5 years. You've heard some of the details. We were forced to increase tuition dramatically and at the same time slash the number of classes that we offer. Our enrollment consequently dropped. It wasn't because the need dropped. In fact, or that Oregonians suddenly lost confidence in our ability to transform their lives. On the contrary, community colleges continue to be among the most highly rated of all public services in this state. No, it was because instead of investing in them, we were disinvesting. Our students, as you know, lead very complicated lives. You've just heard a great example. Nearly all of them work, many full-time. They have families. They have lots of responsibilities. When their course scheduling options become limited, their educational and future job readiness options become limited. The dream is deferred. There was an excellent article in yesterday's Oregonian discussing a study by the Oregon Student Association demonstrating the impact of fewer courses on the course offerings at the university level, leading students to have to wait longer before they can graduate. The problem at the community colleges is even more severe. When options are not there at the front end, when students have less time and money invested, and their confidence in themselves and their confidence in their place in higher education is most fragile, the dream may not merely be deferred for a year or two, it may be deferred forever. And this is a disaster for us as a community. The problem is not only one of access, it's also one of quality. Access to quality instruction and student service. Among those courses that remain, more and more of them are being taught by transient part-time faculty, as the Oregonian article also pointed out. At my own college and at others around the state, we have seen an increasing reliance on part-time instructors to teach the institution's core classes. At PCC, students now do not even have a 50-50 chance of getting a full-time instructor. And in some areas, the odds are actually much worse. For non-traditional students such as ours, this greatly lowers their chances of success. Yesterday in Salem, we had a hearing on House Bill 2578, which is an attempt to proactively deal with the staffing crisis in higher education. And we heard outstanding testimony from a number of faculty, students, and administrators on this issue. While the faculty and administrators do not completely agree on the specifics of how to rectify this problem, there was universal consensus as to its cause, the long-term disinvestment in higher education in this state. So what will it take to make the kind of investment that's needed? Let me say that I really admire and appreciate Governor Kulongoski for his long-term vision for K-20 education in this state. The more that I work with the State Board of Education, the more convinced I am that the future of this state lies with a seamless educational continuum and proper investment in all sectors of the educational continuum. But even the amount for community colleges that is in his budget is not yet an investment. At PCC, it barely brings us back to where we were 7 years ago when the need was so much less. And as you know, the co-chair's budget provides even less for the colleges and universities. Now, some people are saying that improvements in the Oregon Opportunity Grant via the shared responsibility model will make up for this planned reduction in our funding. The grant will certainly provide much-needed tuition relief for many needy students, which is vital. And I should tell you, I just heard from my colleague, Michael Morrow, that over the last 5 years, the debt held by students at PCC has tripled. And that's legal debt. I think that's debt that they know of, as opposed to credit cards and other things. This is a huge problem. But even the increase in the grant will not provide the courses, the teachers, and the programs that these students also need unless we also continue to jack up tuition. And we don't want to do that. That will drive away those potential students who are just testing the waters of higher education with a course or two. What we need is an allocation for the community colleges that is much closer to the $529 million identified as necessary by the OCCA. For PCC, that would allow us to invest in high-demand but high-cost, cutting-edge programs that are currently out of our reach. Among other things, it would allow us to correctly staff the newly expanded Southeast Center, which, as I think you've heard, is one of the real outstanding successes that we've had over the last few years. But it's staffed almost entirely by part-timers, and students need to leave that campus to be able to complete their education. Senators and representatives, members of the committee, community colleges are the great success story of the American educational experience and of the American public sector. We certainly have seen that in Oregon. It's thanks to the many individuals, faculty, staff, and students alike who have been willing to invest the hours and the effort committed to pursuing this dream. But we can only do so much, and we need your help. You heard from Mr. Van Raden about the benefits of community colleges for the business community and just how much we can provide for them. And what he felt was the return commitment of the business community to the colleges. And so I urge you to look to them to help you to make this commitment. There's been talk for some time of increasing Oregon's corporate minimum tax, which hasn't been raised since the days of Herbert Hoover. It's time to move forward with this. It is time for the citizens and the business community of this state to join us in making this modest investment that will clearly redound to our benefit. Members of the committee, we look to you for support, and we look to you, to this committee particularly, for leadership. On behalf of us all, thank you for letting me testify and for having these field hearings, which are really important to the faculty and other citizens of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Denver. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you very much. And before we get to, I have a list of people who signed up for public testimony. I just wanted to recognize two people that are here, and I think illustrating that there is, people do see education as on a continuum. And although in the budget we have finite resources, and at one level you might look and say, well, K through 12 is competing against community colleges, competing against Oregon University System. I've seen representatives and people of all of those groups working together trying to get strong investment in all of the sectors of the education system and community. So first I wanted to recognize that the Chancellor of the Oregon University System is here, Dr. George Pernsteiner. So maybe if you just, right, so thank you very much. And also former Portland City Commissioner and member of the State Board of Higher Education, Mr. Jim Francisconi, is here.
And thank you. And I don't know if you want to... No, you don't. Okay, all right. Thank you. Thank you for being here. All right, so it's 6:35. We have about 12 people signed up. And the idea was to... I told the committee members that we'd be done by 7. So I don't want you to get me in too much trouble. So to the extent you can be, you know, concise and to the point, but we want to hear. So I'm going to call up, I'm just going to call up people two at a time. You might not have signed up together. I'm going to call up two at a time. If you can, you know, state your name and any, you know, affiliation or who you are and why you're here, and then get right to it, that would be wonderful. And I'm also going to read the names of the two people who will be up next, just so you know. So the first two people that I'm going to call up who signed up are Marilyn Lane, and then also Lindsay, is it DeRocher, who's the Vice President for Finance and Administration from Portland State University. Oh, and on deck, thank you.
How important and how much we appreciate the opportunity and you making the trip to listen and hear our pleas to you, and as you are indefinitely in leadership positions. My name is Marilyn Lane. I am, I guess I have my foot in all aspects of the community, of the K through higher ed continuum. Currently, I am president of the Oregon Community College Association Board. I am a board member of Clatsop Community College, and I am assistant superintendent of Astoria School District. So I, and I've been to higher ed, so, you know, I cover the bases. And it is from that perspective that I would like to point out something of which you're, I know you are aware. But as I have been an educator in Oregon for many years, and have watched this state be, and notice I'm saying the state, I'm not pointing fingers at you, but this state has been unwilling to invest adequately in the infrastructure of our public education system. And as an Oregonian and a person committed to how education can change lives, that's a very disturbing trend. We, as you may know, we have, as a state, have gone from well above the national average in our spending on post-secondary education over the last 40 years to well below the average, the national average. Even states north and south of us who have suffered the effects of property tax limitation, of downturns in the economy, still have done better than we have at funding our public education system. The key principle printed in the recently issued co-chair's budget, which I happen to have some of it right here, the key principle, the very first thing that they state is to emphasize investments that promote self-sufficiency and community vitality. At the same time, the budgets recommended by the co-chairs for community college is well below the governor's budget, well below our estimated need of $529 million, and for all practicality, completely ignores capital construction in colleges and universities. Investing in community colleges is at the heart of investments that promote self-sufficiency and community vitality. We, as the 17 community colleges, do have specific justifiable data to back up our request of $529 million for operations. At Clatsop Community College, we could freeze tuition, which, believe me, as a board member, I really want to do at $60 per credit. It's very agonizing to have to vote for tuition increases, which we have had to do almost every year I've been on the board. At $529 million, Clatsop Community College could provide a marine and environmental science associate of applied science degree to meet the needs of local industry, our forestry, fisheries, tourism, governmental agencies, our community needs. At Clatsop Community College, we could increase health occupations programs. At Clatsop Community College with 529, we could significantly enhance the student success, thereby improving student retention. The kinds of support that you have heard so eloquently stated from others testifying before me that we need to provide to students to make sure they have the successful academic backgrounds. And at $529 million, Clatsop Community College could complete the NAFEF industry certification for its automotive technology program, therefore significantly improving the employability of program graduates. And Senator Devlin, you asked if we could break down what it would do between the governor's budget, the 529, and now the new money in $10 million increments. I don't know that at Clatsop Community College we can do that. We will certainly do our best, but certainly we can, I mean, because we're working from the governor's budget to build our budget right now, but we do know that these are things that we can do with the 520.
Mr. Chairman, not that any one of us would want to go that way, but I'd also be interested in what you might have to cut.
Well, I certainly don't want to go that way as a board member, but I hear what you're saying. At Clatsop Community College, without the assistance in capital construction, we will be sorely limited by our abilities to meet the educational needs of the North Coast community. The age, I don't know how many of you have visited our campus, the age and location, it's a condemned high school on a very steep hill, is very ill-suited to meet the needs of the 21st century workforce and citizenry. And while we work hard to improve our learning outcomes and the connections among our area high schools, similarly to as you heard from Beaverton, to ensure that more students are prepared for the demands of the citizen worker, of citizen worker, family member, and lifelong learners, it's really hard to do without that investment, without that revenue. So you are in a wonderful position to be leaders and to help us fund the infrastructure, to help us make that U-turn in that downward slide that we have been witnessing in this state for far too many years. And we need not just the operating funds of 529, we need the capital construction funds for our projects, and we need the student financial aid. And those are all three interrelated. We cannot do it without that. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lane.
Thank you. I'm Lindsay DeRochet with Portland State University. I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at Portland State. And thank you for your very eloquent comments. They really helped me, inspired me to be able to make these comments. First, I wanted to thank Mr. Galizio, the chair, and the members for coming out here. Also, you were at Portland State a few weeks back. We appreciate the long hours you're putting in. You have a very hard job. I think we all understand that. We know that. But we want to make our case to you, and it's a very, very important that we tell you what the facts are. And also, greetings from President Bernstein. I should do that first. We're pleased to be at PCC. We are close partners with the community colleges in this region. PCC is one of our major partners. We are a four-year institution that receives a lot of the students that get their start here, and we want to continue to be able to be that. We encourage people to use the community colleges and then be able to come for their four-year degrees to Portland State. It's a very major part of our mission. There are strains, however, at Portland State. The co-chair's budget does reduce the operating support for the university system, and it is going to be difficult to absorb those reductions, but the focus of my very few comments today needs to be on the capital side. We own a great deal of the state's assets, and many of those assets are old. They are very old. In the case of Lincoln Hall, 1911, the assets of the state need to be preserved and maintained. And in managing those assets for the state, the Oregon University System and Portland State University, we are doing the best job we can to try to keep those facilities functioning to meet a growing demand. Of course, you all who know, I believe, that Portland State has grown to a 25,000 student level in the last 10 years. We have too little space, but the state space that we do have, we are trying to maintain and preserve. We have sadly not had sufficient dollars to maintain the space, therefore we have accumulated a very large deferred maintenance problem. In the system overall, it's $640 million. At Portland State, we get a great, almost third share of that. Some of the projects that are in the governor's budget must be done in order to keep the facilities open and functioning. Lincoln Hall in particular, and the Sciences Building, number two. We believe that this is a matter of a sacred trust. We have built these facilities, we've acquired these facilities, this is where our students learn, this is where our faculty work, we need to bring to you this problem of underinvestment in the state's facilities. Now, we have tried to be very creative at Portland State, and I thank the committee, Susan Morgan's comments from last time, for we have tried to be creative in finding ways to bring other sources of revenue to bear to help us do certain things. And we're going to continue to try to do that at Portland State, to be creative in how we add to our facilities and help develop those facilities. But the problem is huge, and the problem is longstanding, and the state needs to address it. So I have many more comments I would like to make, but you have many more witnesses that you would like to hear from, and I want to thank you for these few moments.
Thank you, Ms. USA and Ms. Lane. Thank you for coming to testify today. So Dick Knight and Patrick Bussell, and then next will be Albert Fahm and Rudy Soto.
Please proceed when you're ready.
Chairman Colizio, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this evening. I'm Dick Knight, and I will be brief. What I'd like to discuss with you is the outstanding work that's being done by the Engineering and Technology Investment Council, and I'd like to urge your support for restoring funding for this highly successful program to the level that was included in the government's recommended budget. Tonight I recommend the represent the advisory board for the Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science at Portland State University. This is a volunteer group of 30-plus members who come from companies in high technology, transportation, civil engineering, structural design, architecture, and software. These companies cover the full range from our largest to our smallest employers, and my own background is similar, having spent much of my career as a vice president at Tektronix and then as the chief operating officer for a startup company. Our group meets frequently throughout the year in order to understand, advise, and support the Massey College in meeting the needs for engineering in Oregon. The Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science is a key resource for both education and economic development. Enrollment is now over 2,000 students, and over 370 students received degrees in 2006. Research has been growing at nearly 20% per year, and has also included work in support of our largest companies, such as Intel and Tektronix, and some of our newest, such as Octavian, which is a startup company being incubated on the PSU campus. These educated students and new growing companies are the lifeblood of a healthy technology sector for our economy, and they are a key source of high-wage employment. The successes being achieved by the Massey College are due in large measure to investments made through ETIC. ETIC investment at PSU has made possible the hiring of key new teaching and research professors, has expanded research and created valuable intellectual property, has improved the quality of undergraduate and graduate education, and has allowed the number of students completing engineering degrees to nearly double. The results are being noticed nationally, and at the risk of slightly violating an embargo, I'd like to share some good news with you. Tomorrow morning, it will be announced that the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the PSU's Massey College has just been ranked ninth in the nation in the new U.S. News and World Report survey of America's best graduate schools. This is recognition, I think, that highlights what the investments in ETIC can and have accomplished. Senior executives from Oregon's companies partnered closely with the Oregon University System and its universities to set ETIC's priorities for engineering investment, to closely monitor the progress of these programs, and to share publicly the metrics on progress and impact. Not only do executives and their companies invest in time in this process to To date, industry has matched the investment of each dollar from the state of Oregon with over $2 of investment from the private sector. Commitment, shared investment, accountability, results. I think ETIC has proven to be a great model. Oregon industry strongly supports this program and stands ready to continue their active involvement and financial support. ETIC has a great track record and high-impact plans. On behalf of the Massey College Advisory Board, I ask you to give particular consideration to increasing the investment in ETIC and restoring funding to the level in the governor's recommended budget. Oregon will greatly benefit from the growth and the opportunities that will result. I'd be happy to entertain questions, and if possible, I'd like to leave you with copies of the testimony. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone with a background in economic development and in my private life has a business that works with high-tech companies around the world, I appreciate the ETIC program. As you know, the co-chair's budget slashed the funding for that program from $17 million down to only $7 million. It's unlikely, in the current budget scenario, that we'll be able to restore full funding to the program. So, like the earlier request by Senator Devin, I would like to better understand what we could do with some incremental add-back to that budget.
We would be happy to work with you to provide that in whatever form you'd like. For reference, in the quanta that Senator Devlin requested, the entire additional request is only one $10 million unit, which, however, is huge in the world in which we live. And Bruce Schaefer works very closely with the ETIC board and can provide probably almost more data than you would like, but we'd be happy to support you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Knight, you could not come up with more data. Representative Edwards, you can't come up with enough data.
He sounds like our
kind. He is in the right place, absolutely. No, there's no doubt about that. So, thank you very much. Over the room. Is it Beisel? Beisel. Mr. Beisel.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. I'm actually going to be providing two testimonies, so I'll try to keep it as brief as I can. Rudy Soto had to leave. So I'm going to be talking on his behalf.
Okay.
I am cognizant of time, so I will try to keep brief. Basically, you have the report in front of you that we passed out. It's called Where Are We At?
Even though I said your name, you need to identify yourself for the record.
Sure. So my name is Patrick Beisel. I'm also a student at Portland State University and a member of the Oregon Student Association. And so, like I mentioned, the report that's in front of you, Where Are We At? Where Are We Going? It was a report released by the Oregon Student Association on Tuesday. Some of you may have already received it. We put a number of them in boxes or gave them to aides, but this is just sort of for you to peruse while I talk about it. So the report was sort of initiated by students, and the concern was how have the cuts of the past 15 years really affected students and staff on the ground? We're talking very, very specific actions that have been taken by students and staff to sort of compensate for the lack of funds. So students, on the whole, were concerned that at the time when a college education becomes more and more important, and you've heard plenty of testimony illuminating that, the amount of time that we're spending in college and the amount of money that we're spending in college continues to grow and expand, and it doesn't happen in time with the need to get more college graduates out into the workforce. So we conducted about 30 interviews, or we used about 30 rather, of staff and faculty in the interview. And we surveyed them and talked to them about the issues, and there's some very good testimony. I would highly encourage you to look over it. I won't go into detail about too much of it. But essentially it's that, and I think Vice President Deroche spoke towards this, but in an effort to keep cuts outside of the classroom, things such as student services have been cut, the IT department, faculty salaries, things that inhibit a student's opportunity and growth in college. So instead of seeing students start to develop and really experiment in college and take different courses that might not be with their major, you're seeing students just stick with the exact amount of credits they need to graduate to get out on time, with the average graduation being 5 years. That's understandable. In addition to the cuts, campuses have been forced to, as noted, increase costs through fees and focus on programs that generate revenue. Programs such as the Massey College, which apparently is ninth in the nation, which I would applaud, I think it's really a testament to the fact that inside the classroom, faculty and staff are doing as much as they can. And at PSU, we have excellent, excellent faculty that, you know, take the time to talk to students. That's not what the report's talking about. The report talks about academic advising, of which I've never had one. I was never offered an academic advisor. I never knew the process to actually attain one, so I've actually been going through college in the hopes that I'm taking the right classes and that someday maybe I'll graduate and, you know, not have $50,000 in loans. I'm up to about 20 right now, and I'm only going into my junior year, so that's a kind of frightening thought. So hopefully sometime I can get some academic advising. The other issue is that with PSU, we have a disproportionately large number of adjunct faculty, to say the least. These adjunct professors do the best that they can with the resources that they're provided, and I've been extremely satisfied with the actual course work and the amount of time that they put in. However, the resources that they're provided, things such as they have no phones, they only have emails or personal emails. Some professors will use their personal cell phone or their home phone for you to contact them. They don't have office space, so it's very difficult to see them outside of class. Just to give a really brief example, I'm an English major, and I had a Shakespeare class my first year, and my teacher actually taught at both PCC and U of O. And this teacher made a commute from Eugene every Tuesday, Thursday, which is quite a commute if you've driven it. And this teacher couldn't hold office hours because she lived in Eugene. And so the class would end, and she would go home. And there was many, many times when I had to ask her a question, and I just had to do it via email. And the emails, understandably, were very brief and just answered the specific question in brief. Didn't go into detail, so that wasn't much help. And this is just one example of the hundreds at PSU of students similar to myself. So to just go into the survey itself really briefly, we surveyed over 4,300 students. And the general consensus, as I spoke to earlier, is one of satisfaction. Students really do enjoy the campuses that they attend, and they do like the professors and the classes. The issue is twofold. One is the inability of students to enroll in the courses that they need to graduate. And the second one is that the costs are impacting students. So the course load has been spoken to a couple of times, so I won't go into detail. But basically, you can't register for a course. You have to wait another year, pay another $5,000 or something. Essentially, the recommendations that we're giving in the report are fourfold. One is to fully fund the shared responsibility model. The other one is to fully fund the community college system, as well as the university system. The other one is to keep the interest earnings on tuition, and I'm not sure how many of you know exactly what I'm talking about, but the interest earnings on tuition would be, the university would be able to keep them and then reinvest that into the university, so to sort of backfill some of the gaps that we've had in the past, increase enrollment, do some innovative stuff with that. And then the last one is to recommend that we increase the corporate minimum tax. And I know some other witnesses talked about that as well, but as mentioned, since Hooper Herbert, 1931, was the last time that it was raised, whereas in comparison, tuition has gone up over 1,000% since 1964. So you can see sort of a disproportionate analysis there. Basically, were the committee to follow those recommendations, we would see not only increases in enrollment, not only increases in faculty, like full-time tenured faculty, but probably a greater satisfaction among students. And you would see the enrollment go down to 4 years graduation. The time to a degree would be much less, and students like myself would graduate with much less debt. So in brief, that's my testimony. I would be more than happy to answer any questions about the survey or anything that I've spoken on. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brissett. I think because of the time, we're running a little short. So thank you, Mr. May. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Albert Baum and Heidi, is it Yorkshire? Heidi, there in the back. And then next will be Cheryl Falk and Frank Gouard.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Albert Baum. I'm a student at Portland State University and was appointed freshman class editor in our student government. And I'm here to talk to you about the ASPIRE program. It stands for Access to Student Assistance Programs in Reach of Everyone. And it's a volunteer-based mentor program that pairs community members with high school students. It helps prepare students by helping them take the right classes apply for a financial aid scholarship, and go through the college selection and admission process. When I went to Aloha High School in the Beaverton School District, I applied to be in the program at the end of my junior year, and when I returned at the beginning of my senior year, I was notified that the program had been cut. And luckily for me, there was a volunteer who decided to stick around, who was a former Aspire counselor, and helped me with scholarships, applications, and college choices. I found that extremely helpful. And I also noticed that many students are often not aware of the resources available for them and the scholarships that they're eligible for, and this program greatly helps address this problem. I believe this program is important to Oregon, and it's an effective way to make sure students are ready for life after high school. Currently, the program is limited to schools along the I-5 corridor and doesn't have a stable funding source. I hope that the state decides to support and implement the Aspire program so that all Oregon families can benefit.
Thank you, Mr.
Good evening. My name is Heidi Yorkshire. My main professional activity for the last 25 years has been as a journalist writing about food and wine. I've written for a lot of national magazines. Basically, people pay me to go around and eat and drink on their money. I was the wine columnist for the Oregonian for 5 years, among other things. I'm here to talk about something completely different, or almost completely different, and I'm at an advantage because I'm only asking you for $15 million. I'm here to talk about Oregon State University's public service programs, including the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Food Innovation Center, and the OSU Extension Service. And before I start, though, I really want to thank you all for your service to the state. I know it takes an unimaginable amount of time and energy and sacrifice to do what you're doing. I'm really glad people run for office, and thank you very much for doing it. The people from OSU, I'm sure, will be talking to you and giving you all the statistics and the 30,000-foot view of, you know, how this all works and all. I'm just here to talk about my own personal experience where my life has touched several of these programs. To start with, as a journalist, eventually writing about food and wine led me into an entrepreneurial project in the specialty food business, specifically in developing a business to produce custom butter in the Willamette Valley. And that involved working with a co-op of 100 farmers in McMinnville Farmers Co-op Creamery. As a complete novice in the dairy business when I got involved in this, I got a lot of helpful advice from the Food Innovation Center, and eventually we hired them to do our consumer testing program for us, which was a key part of trying to decide whether to bring this product to market. I could have gone all kinds of places out in the world to get this kind of help, but it was fantastic to be able to go right in Portland and to find outstanding first-class professional work. We paid for that, of course, but we paid, I think, considerably less than we would have on the open market for that kind of high-end, very sophisticated consumer testing. It taught us a lot, and it was very well done, and it was, although that business never ended up opening, it helped us learn what we were going to learn as small business people and entrepreneurs, which is part of what Oregon's all about. Also, I'm a business advisor for the Small Business Development Center in Portland, and I work with people mostly who are starting specialty food businesses. And we took our Small Business Development Center business development program to the Food Innovation Center, and working with them, they developed a whole class called Bringing Your Recipe to Market, which helps specialty foods entrepreneurs. Again, this is expertise that you can't, I can't tell you how hard it is to find this kind of expertise. They have excellent people there. They have excellent resources. They developed a wonderful program that I know has helped a lot of entrepreneurs who even wanted to start or to grow their businesses. And in some cases, it taught people that maybe their business shouldn't get started, which is an advantage in itself. But these are all businesses that serve agriculture in Oregon. All right, there was just one other thing I want to talk about. I've been very involved with Portland Farmers Market for the 15 years that the market has existed. Probably some of you know about the market. It's in Portland State Campus on Saturdays. We are now open from April. I say we. I was on the board for years, and I can't stop saying we about that market. We usually have about 150 vendors through the height of the season now. And Extension was a great partner for us, the master food preservers, the master composters, the master gardeners. They manage tables at the market. They taught people so much about how to use the produce that and the nursery products as well that were being offered at the market. You think of an urban area as not being a place that extension is important. But in fact, the Master Food Preservers program helps people start businesses. It helped farmers sell more because, you're going to buy two peaches if you're going to eat them in 2 days. But, heck, if you're going to preserve those peaches, you're probably going to go out and get 100 pounds of them. At least that's what I did a couple years ago. So I just wanted to also say that extension is a very important program. And it has a real ripple effect on the health, on the agriculture, and on the quality of life in Oregon. And like I said, it's only $15 million. So after all this $529 million, just a drop in the bucket. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ms. Yorkshire, for your testimony, for making us really hungry. And Mr. Perrin, appreciate that. All right, Cheryl Falk and Frank Goulart. And then following that will be Michael Morrow and Michael Fonleitner.
Mr. Chair, where they're queuing up, if I might just make a comment about the programs that the last witness was talking about are really what they're longstanding programs, and they really are ETIC for the agricultural sector and the forest products sector and the commercial fishing sector. These are the programs that help develop the innovative kinds of things that keep those sectors vibrant economically, and they are really important programs.
Thank you.
College in Salem. I was originally here to provide testimony about high school and community college partnerships, but somehow my name was left off the list. And so I've changed tactics and said, I will say this much, however. High school community college partnerships are alive and well and flourishing in parts of the state other than in metropolitan Portland. And we have numerous partnerships going on. They have increased exponentially since the discussion about and then the passage of Senate Bill 300. So I want to thank you very much for passing that bill. It has increased conversation and partnerships immensely. Not all of them are Senate Bill 300 partnerships, but it doesn't matter. They're working well. So thank you. I would like to just give about 1 minute's worth of testimony about the budget for community colleges, and that would be this. For every $10 million of increment as far as funding for community colleges goes, that means $1.2 million for Chemeketa. An equivalency or equivalencies for you to think about as far as what that means to us would be the following. $4 in tuition per credit hour per student. 1 to 2 outreach centers or campuses, and that would be in Dallas and Woodburn and McMinnville and Fannin State. 450 course sections with about 10,800 students worth of enrollment. 18 faculty positions and 1 to 2 professional technical programs. So when we think about those increments, we think about very specific things that we do for our communities and for our students. And I just thought that might be helpful. Some other time, I'd love to talk with you about high school partnerships, when we have more time.
Well, thank you, Ms. Paulson. Sorry about that oversight. Appreciate it.
This is Frank Goulart. I'm here at Portland Community College, the faculty department chair in mathematics and also teaching math here at College Chair Galizio and respectful senators and representatives that make up this committee. My colleagues throughout the state, some of which are at Lynn Benton Community College, where Senator Morris is, or at Rogue and also at Umpqua Community Colleges, where you are, I know them intimately, or at Blue Mountain, where Representative Jensen is, they say the same things or see the same things that I experience in that the students and the infrastructure that we have in place at our state's community college system is at a straining point right now. We do a great job, and I'm not saying that brashly. We're doing a great job with what we have. But with the current co-chair's budget, or even the governor's budget, We're just putting fingers in the dike. It's a really tough job, and I see it at the front lines. In our math department, and you can probably empathize or sympathize that a lot of folks are math anxious in our society. In our math department here at Sylvania Campus alone, we see 10,000 students a year, every year, two-thirds of which are math anxious, just dealing with developmental ninth grade level math. It is tough on them, and I see the strain. And the strain is then duplicated and triplicated with the lack of resources we have in, for example, the number of full-time faculty that are available to us, or the number of academic advisors that could help them, the number of courses offered. Chair Galizio asked about the previous two students who didn't have daytime classes at their campus, and that's true at Sylvania campus too, that we can't offer all the sections we'd like to offer to help meet these students' needs. So the infrastructure is there, and we need to fix it as a state. This state, by the year 2014, is going to need 660,000 newly educated, skilled workers. And as we all know, the community college system, along with OUS, has got to be the key supplier of those folks. And for the sake of us, all of us, Oregonians, we're all taxpayers, we're all loyal to our wonderful state, we need some help. We need you to help fund and not look at the current co-chair's budget as a status quo. That's a disinvestment in our future, a future of all of us. Those future students of ours, who are future educated workers, will be serving us in some capacity or another, whether it's now or in the near future or in the faraway future. So please make an investment in our future in careful consideration as you pore over the budgets, rather than a current disinvestment, which is the state we're in at this point with the co-chair's budget. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. Mr. Michael Morrow, Mr. Michael Fonleitner. And is Mary Spilde here? There you are. Okay, you're up next. You're our last speaker. And I want to thank the committee for going already past the time that I promised. I'm in a lot of trouble, folks, so help me.
You are. Chair Galizio and members of the committee, my name is Michael Morrow. I'm an academic professional here at Portland Community College. My office is about 200 feet southwest of us, and I have food there. Unfortunately, not enough to share. A speech instructor should know that one of the dictums is the mind can only absorb as much as the backside can endure. So I really appreciate you hanging in with us on this. I am in student services, so I deal with people. My job is to keep students here at PCC. So I thought it might be informative to give you a little bit of information that I share with my students about financial aid. When I'm working with student groups, I will ask them sometimes four questions. One question is, do you know what you're paying for tuition and fees right now at PCC? Do you know what you would have paid 10 years ago? Do you know what your friends in California are paying right now at community colleges? And do you know what I paid to get all of my degrees in California? And the answers are interesting. Students here right now are paying $67 a credit, which is more than twice as much as they would have been paying 10 years ago. Students right now in California are paying $22 a credit at community colleges. We are paying triple here in Oregon what they're paying in California. And then the kicker, of course, is I got an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a master's degree in California, granted a little while ago, for less than our students pay right now for one term at Portland Community College. So the disinvestment in education is fairly widespread. What that brings me to is the second page of the handout, which talks about financial aid. There are some numbers on here. I'm not sure whether people have presented those to you. This is just Portland Community College. But some of the more interesting ones are have to do with borrowing. Just 5 years ago, 6 years ago, before the troubles, Portland Community College saw $10 million in borrowing. Our students, 3,093 of them, borrowed $10 million. Last year, 7,000 students borrowed $31 million. Borrowing here has tripled in just 5 years. In just 5 years. And what concerns me are the students I deal with on a daily basis who take out $4,000 and $6,000 and $7,000 a year in loans and then drop out after 2 or 3 years. Drop out. Now, Senator Devlin asked, what could we do with a few extra dollars in increments of $10 million. One of my many hats with the college is I am the financial aid advisor for a program, a federally funded SSS TRIO program called the Sylvania Roots Program. We work with 170 low-income, first-generation students. Many have learning disabilities. All have tested into pre-college level math and writing classes. These are 170 students that you would not generally expect to do well. We have in this program, with those students, produced a retention rate from spring term to the next fall term of 82%. For the rest of the students at the college, it's about 50%. We have an overall GPA of 3.1. We have helped those students raise over $600,000 in scholarships. Many of our students, and this is first-generation, low-income students, often not even native English speakers, are transferring to four-year colleges, including private colleges. We are sending students to Lewis and Clark, George Fox, Linfield. Our students are doing wonderfully. So what does this have to do with what another $10 million would do? Well, we are spending $1,800 per year for that 170 students who are graduating at higher rates than the rest of the students at the college. Now, what if we could take that 2,000 students we graduate every year and increase that by 500, increase that by 25%? That's what $10 million would do. $10 million, PCC's share, would allow us to do the Sylvania Roots program 9 times. So that 170 students, we could bump up to 1,500 students. So what would the payback be? These would be students who would be getting associate degrees, transferring to four-year schools, getting four-year degrees, going out in the workforce, and earning a great deal more money, earning family wages rather than survival wages. And they would pay back through taxes into the system much, much more than the money on the table to assist them to get through the system. So I just wanted to make folks aware of what our students are going through now, the amount of borrowing they have to take on, and the fact that there are programs available. PCC is looking at the success of our program, and one of the things that excited us about the governor's budget was that there would be money available to take what we have learned from our program, which includes, you know, intensive advising, it includes a lot of financial aid advising, and provide that for a much larger percentage of our population, and not just the PCC, we could do it statewide. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Oh, Senator Dillon?
Mr. Chairman, I know we're trying to close up here, but I did want to ask a quick question, Mr. Monroe. Because you talked to a lot of students about financial aid and their situation. I know Congress is trying to reverse this, but do students realize with the substantial increase in interest just how much more onerous their debt is?
One of the interesting things about statistics on here, because of the financial exigencies at the college, we have been able to increase the number of people working in the financial aid office by about 10% or 15% in the last 10 years. They are processing twice as many applications and giving away 5 times as much money with fewer additional people. What that means is, and some of us went to school a while ago. I was at the U of O 20 years ago, and I wanted to take out a small loan. I had to sit down with a financial aid advisor for 30 minutes and have her explain to me, and I was not a kid. I was a 40-year-old man. I knew about finances. But you had to get the loan, sit down with a financial aid advisor and have her go through all of the ins and outs of what it means to take out a loan. We don't do that now. We make students go online on their own and figure out somewhere in there what it means to take out a loan and what it means to pay it back and what it means when the feds raise your 3.4% interest rate on a Stafford loan to 6.8% and what that's going to look like over a 10-year payback. And that's of concern to me because when our students take that debt on, they're not thinking about what it means because we don't have the face-to-face means to provide them with that information. A lot of students can go online and can get the information they need, but a lot of students need somebody to look at them and walk them through the process, just like Frank does in a math class. You need somebody there to explain what that means to you and really make sure you understand that you will have to pay it back because bankruptcy no longer applies to financial aid. That loan will follow you the rest of your life. And the amount of money our students are paying back now, especially those who drop out, those are funds that are not available to them to do other things in the Oregon economy, like buy houses and buy cars and do those kinds of things because they've got this massive debt. And especially students who don't finish a degree and don't transfer still have to pay the loan back. Thank you. Good question.
Thank you. Mr. Sumleitner.
Hi. I'm Michael Sumleitner. I teach political science at PCC. I'm one of two full-time faculty people. Count them, two. One, two. in the entire system on all campuses that is full-time in political science. I'm the only one of those two who teaches state and local government. I'm also the chair of the Peace and Conflict Studies focus area. That gives you a little bit of an idea of where I'm coming from. I would like to be the first one this evening to ask you a couple of questions and maybe have a show of hands. I'm just curious. One is, how many of you ever took a political science course as part of your undergraduate career? Big surprise there that elected politicians would be there. Second, and I'm not trying to be odd here, but how many of you attend with some regularity church, synagogue, mosque, or perhaps pray pantheistically to your backyard garden? Me too. So we have that in common. Oftentimes in my political science classes, I ask students to be political, to make value judgments. And part of that relates to their heroes and who they look up to. And I'm fairly honest in my classes. I say, well, for example, I was raised to ask, what would Jesus do? And I have since come to ask, what would Buddha do? What would Muhammad do? What would Gandhi do? What would Martin Luther King do? And I try to find a woman or two to ask, what would Dorothy Day do? What would Alice Paul do? And maybe it's my strange imagination, but all these people had something in common, and that was the concern for the least of these, my brethren. So as you do to the least of these, you do to me. At the community college, we try to help the least of these, far more dramatically than I would suggest at more restricted enrollment institutions. You've heard lots of data. But I'm asking you to think about value judgments here, like I ask my own students. $25 million to restore what the governor has asked. It's really a fairly small percentage of the overall budget that you folks are going to be asked to overall present in the next 2 years. Even $71 million, that's a press. I understand, that's a tough one. And I understand that they're competing priorities. There always are. But that's what politics is about, is having your values inform your priorities. Let me be blunt. Would Jesus, fund more prisons as compared to fund more Head Start programs? Now, I'm not saying there's a right answer there, but I would like to enter into that discussion with you at some time, or Buddha, or Gandhi, or whoever you'd like. Now, in political science here, let me give you an idea of where we stand at PCC. I've mentioned two full-time faculty. We have a half dozen part-time faculty. We have basically the resources of anthropology and most other small social science departments. In state and local government that you are devoting your lives to right now, we have three sections being offered on all four campuses this coming spring. Next week. Three, for the total possible enrollment of 38, will have less than 100 students able to take state and local government because of our budget situation. I'm not complaining to our administration. I'm complaining to our allocation of resources as a society. My basic U.S. government class textbook points out how half of adults in America cannot name the three branches of government. 40% can't name both of the U.S. senators from their state. Only about 25% can name their congressperson from their district. And I don't want you to even ask how many of your constituents know your names.
Four.
Four!
And one lives in my house.
Congress.
Yeah, that's right.
What I'm asking you is to consider the abundance of data that has been presented to you, the testimony of those who are hurting here at the community college level, the belt tightening that has been taking place for the past 3 to 4 years, and what we need to do for the future of this state. Ignorance is not a prescription for success. We need more sections of political science, just as we need more sections of math. I'm not saying which is the more important. What I'm saying is, the least of these who desire to come to the community college because they can't afford to go anywhere else, cannot afford increased tuition, cannot afford increased cost of textbooks. What they can afford is for you to take some risks and to make some hard value judgments. And in terms of the Ways and Means Committee, I'd be happy to spend 2 more hours with you this evening about my thoughts when it comes to tax reform, because we don't have any. I'm not talking about corporate. I'm talking about a 1930 personal income tax that you know is the lion's share of your resources, which is basically a flat rate tax because it's become that way because it hasn't effectively been modified in 70 years. That's disgraceful to Democrats and Republicans. I'm talking about how we can modify that to make it genuinely progressive, more helpful to the least of these, my brethren, and possibly be more progressive on other fronts. And we could talk about Bill Clinton's BTU tax, which fell flat in Congress, but I thought it was a good idea. I didn't much like Bill Clinton in a lot of ways, but hey, if we really want to stand for conservation, we can. I'm not talking about gas tax here. I'm talking about an encouragement to reduce our consumption of natural resources by raising revenue for those who consume more than they need to. We can be creative about taxes. We don't have to be talking about budget pies that are finite. I'd like us to be more creative as we serve, I hope, the least of these, my brethren. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Mary Spilday, thank you very much, both of you. Take us home. I like how you... Well, I'm not going to say. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Spilday. I'm president of Lane Community College in Eugene, and thank you very much for extending your time to allow all of us to speak. I'm not a political scientist. I'm a recovering lawyer, which may be even scarier. But I do want to talk about the budget. We know that a college degree is vital to productive employment and career success in the future. We know emphatically that the more education a person has, the more earning power he or she has, and the more likely he or she is to be employed. We know that 87% of the new jobs projected for Oregon in this decade require at least an associate's degree. Yet there's a disconnect. Oregon ranks third among 15 Western states for the highest community college tuition. The percentage of students served by Oregon Community College has declined by 12% since 2001, and that's due to increases in tuition and elimination and reduction of programs. Oregon ranks 45th among states for families' ability to afford community college education. And we rank 46th among states for state funding for students. And I ask you, is this what we want for Oregon? We know all this, yet there's a huge disconnect, particularly in community colleges. At Lane, our goals have been to give everyone the skills to be ready for college, to provide college access for all, and to continue and, if possible, expand the programs we have in professional and career training. But these goals are seriously threatened in these budget times. Why do I think this? Well, the State Board request was for $529 million plus capital construction, as you know. The Governor allocated $483 million. While on its face, this is a 12.7% increase from this biennium, in reality, it does not make up for the disinvestment of the last several years. In fact, based on our appropriation in 2001, it is only a 4% increase, and that doesn't include inflation. If you were to roll up the 2001 figure for inflation, the number should be $560 million for community colleges. But the governor gave us a good start, and we're realistic, so we're supporting the $529 million.
the release of the co-chair's budget allocating $458 million to community colleges was a total shock. In fact, it's more than a shock. With all due respect, it is an outrage. The disinvestment in community colleges has been going on for years with disastrous consequences. Tuition at Lane has increased 92% in 6 years. Programs and services have been reduced or eliminated, affecting students' ability to attend college or choose from the range of programs they need. The co-chair's budget is $4 million less than the 2001 appropriation, and that's in 2001 dollars. So what's the impact of this? Well, each college is at a different place in their budget cycle. For Lane this year, we are 20% short of state funding of where we were in 2001. We have cut $14 million from the budget in the last 5 years, and this year we will cut another $7 to $8 million. There's nothing left in operations. This will mean cuts in instructional programs and services. That will lead to a loss of enrollment, which is the beginning of a death spiral for the college. We have three unacceptable options. Cut our most expensive instructional programs, the kind of programs that prepare people for work, things like nursing and dental hygiene and aviation maintenance. We can lay off more staff, and just order of magnitude, to come up with $78 million, we will be laying off 50 to 60 faculty and staff. Or we can increase tuition, and I've already told you we've increased it 92%, and we don't think that is an option for our students. We recognize that there will never be enough public money to do everything we need to do for the community. We have taken steps to grow revenue streams, and they're beginning to work, but it takes time. We have also taken steps to control costs. But let's be clear, those steps require us to look at our full-time, part-time ratio, to look at our class size, to look at reducing salary and benefits, and all of these detract from what I think we want to do in our community colleges. Businesses need an educated and trained workforce. We want to help with that, but it is becoming increasingly difficult. Enrollment declined in the OUS system last year, and the decline in community college transfers was cited as the place where enrollment was lost. It should come as no surprise, as we are cutting our programs, that the pipeline for transfer students just isn't there. With only 33% of incoming high school freshmen starting higher education, and with the need for post-secondary education as an essential component in gaining a family wage job, how does Oregon expect to be competitive? I was recently elected by my peers to the board of our national association, the American Association of Community Colleges. I sit with presidents representing about 32 other states. As we talk around the table, I find that Oregon is the poster child for disinvestment. Every other state is investing in their community colleges. Everyone knows about the disinvestment in Oregon, and make no mistake, they are clapping their hands in glee, because if we are disinvesting, that lessens their competition for good jobs, it lessens our opportunity for getting the best faculty and administrators, and it lessens their competition for the best trained and educated workforce. The question, I think, is what do we want Oregon community colleges to be like in the future? We may not be able to return to the golden years when Oregon was seen as the bellwether state regarding our investment in education. But what do we want our educational system to be in the future? If we go down the path of the co-chair's budget, we will be less competitive as a state, citizens will have less access to a college education, and therefore less access to family wage jobs. Again, is this what we want for Oregon? If we are funded at the $529 million level, there is a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. We can move from a virtually hopeless situation back to where we provide hopeful futures for our students, our communities, and our state. Community colleges have been patient. Throughout the decade of the 90s, we were told, wait, just wait, and it will be your turn. And in 2001, it was our turn, and we all know how long that lasted. If not now, then when we have a good economy to fund community colleges? Please reverse this disinvestment and fund us at the $529 million level. and give us the chance to do what needs to be done for our students and for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Spillay. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mary, for your comments. I realize you did not have those prepared to deliver to us, but I would request, if it's not an inconvenience, if you could email.
I was editing as I was going that I could keep with it.
I did notice that.
Yeah.
But to the extent that you could share that with us,
I would be happy to
do
that.
Very much appreciated.
Certainly,
thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, for everyone on the committee.
Yeah.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you for coming. I'd like to ask you a question that I really don't like you to choose in the question. But sometimes we have to make choices in the legislature that we don't like to make either. Theoretically, if our choice was to fund at, let's say theoretically at $510 million plus $20 million in debt service for capital, or to fund at $529 million with no debt service for capital, which I know is not a choice that anybody would like to make, which would be best for the community college system?
Well, that's a Sophie's choice, isn't it?
I know.
I can answer that question for Lynn Dunn.
And I can't answer that question for the other community colleges. For Lane and for the long-term sustainability of the college, the operating funds are clearly more important because that creates our base for the future. But having said that, we need that health and wellness building because without it, we will not be able to expand our nursing program and meet the needs of our community. So I know that was a yes or no answer. And
I know.
That's a difficult decision that you have to make. We want it all.
No doubt a very successful attorney and president.
Yeah.
Representative Morgan.
If I might, Mr. Chair, the issue around capital construction for community colleges is one that we have been grappling with rather inelegantly for some time in the legislature. And the track record is simply that there isn't one. And that the system, there was a capital investment program when the system came into being more than 30 years ago. But then, except for the last biennium, there hasn't been a capital construction program. And the concept has always been that the community colleges follow the model of the K-12 system, where finance. In the legislative arena about the appropriateness of the legislature stepping into capital construction support for the community colleges. The situation for higher ed is somewhat different because they don't have a tax base and a relationship with local patrons the same way that the K-12 system does and that the community college system does. So I have always come at this argument from a perspective that for the community college system and for the K-12 system, the operating budgets are the crucial piece from the state perspective. And we have, as I think has been discussed here, and we discuss at length, we have not got a real vibrant economy in this state when you compare us to our northern neighbors or our southern neighbors. And we just simply don't have the capacity to take on a lot of extra programs and do a good job on the programs that we are responsible for funding historically. So in that context, I think that the discussion that we have around capital construction projects for community colleges is a rather strained one and not one that we come to very easily.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if I might respond briefly, I do understand that struggle, and I think historically it was much easier for community colleges to go out and get local funding. I do not think that is the case any longer. There were 27 measures on the Lane County ballot in November, and none of the county measures passed. Local city measures, local school measures passed. None of the county measures passed, and for example, Lane Community College would be in that county-wide measure. For our match, for our building, our foundation is
having a capital campaign to, and we're moving forward with that to get the money, because it's very difficult, I think, to pass bonds locally.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, I do very much appreciate what you're saying, and I understand it. I think that the one of the things that is interesting in terms of a model is what the higher ed system has done with private endowments in terms of capital construction, and that from the perspective of the community colleges, that may be, I know that the system is moving very aggressively in that direction. And from what I see with the stresses on state budgeting, that is to expect the state to step up and become significant players in a capital construction program for community colleges or K-12 is going to be a very difficult process.
Representative Morgan, I understand that. I think every community college has stepped up its foundation efforts, but we're about probably 10 to 15 years behind where the universities are in terms of those efforts. So in the meantime, I mean, we're working on it, and I would say in 15 to 20 years, I expect Lane Community College will have a very healthy foundation, but we're in the nascent stages right now, and it's going to take some time for us to be as good at that as our university neighbors are. The other thing is that our alumni they probably tend to stay in the community. They tend not to be quite as affluent as, again, as university graduates. And it is a little more difficult for us to stake out our claim to those philanthropic dollars, although we're working very, very hard to do so. Thank you very much for
traveling so far to come up here. So, before I close this, did anyone on the dais want to make any closing comments or anything? No, just hungry. We're looking for us. Ms. Yorkshire here, the food and wine person. So, but seriously, the idea today was to have an informational meeting, and this was very informative. And I think that's from the perspective of, well, at least this person sitting up here, I really appreciate it. And all the time and effort that Portland Community College put into this, and really appreciate all of you that took the time out of your busy schedules to show up today. This is an ongoing conversation, and this has been very helpful to us, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank members of the committee. I want to thank Eric Sorensen and Steve Bender for working overtime. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting. And